Welcome to Scenes, conversations in culture with the people who know it best. We chat with guests across music, art, fashion, film, sport and technology in a bid to understand the scenes we love that little bit better. I'm your host Lenny and I'm over the moon that in this episode I am joined by the compelling Lol Hammond, musician, producer, DJ, music supervisor and all-round legend. We chatted about the correlation between punk and acid house, the early 90s rave scene leading up to the 1994 Criminal Justice Act, British cinema and life as a music supervisor. A couple of quick housekeeping bits before we get going. Firstly, I apologise that it sounds like I've dialed into the call using a phone box. And secondly, you'll hear Lol mention someone called Gemma a few times. Gem is also an incredible music supervisor who Lol and I both have the pleasure of knowing. I hope you enjoy the show.
Can you tell us the first thing you remember falling in love with and the impact it has had on you later in life?
Yeah, I mean, I think I've always loved, so I've probably got the perfect job over the last sort of 20 years. I've always loved music and film, Lenny. So it's supposed to be a double impact. It's seeing films, because I grew up in the 80s, you know, seeing films, although they've probably come out in the 70s actually, but films. But I really loved all those British films like Quadrophenia, Get Carter. So I loved it, like a lot of boys of my age, I suppose. I love those British performance with Jagger. I just love British cinema. And music-wise, I was still at school. I was a bit too young, really, for the whole punk thing. But that had a massive effect on me. When I don't know what old I was, 12 or 13, when people like Ian Dury and The Clash and all those amazing bands. I just like the attitude. I think the attitude is very similar to Acid House as well. The whole DIY thing, you know, I like the way, because my parents bought me a guitar when I was 11, 12, and I was really daunted by it because, you know, I used to see these guys like Brian May, Queen, and the guy, you know, Jimmy Page and Led Zeppelin. I thought, oh my God, how the hell am I going to, I'm going to have to stay in my bedroom for the next 10 years. And then all of a sudden, of course, yeah, I like Dr. Feelgood. So all those bands, yeah. All of a sudden, yeah, they're just using three chords, you know, The Clash, The Pistols. Yeah. It's like, okay, hold on. So characters like me could have a go. So that was that was brilliant. It reminded me of Acid. I was exactly the same sort of thing. So I was in a little band, blah, 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 and made some records. But the same thing, it reminded me so much of an Acid House in 88 when that took off, same sort of thing. You know, it was just like I sort of learned myself keyboards, had to use a sampler and a drum machine. So very similar. I think there's a lot of similarities between punk and Acid House, actually.
I see. Yeah, I love that comparison. Now, I've done a little bit of research, and from what I can see, your story is a pretty rich tapestry. So I was wondering if you could give us, I suppose, a brief history of Lol Hammond.
Yeah. So I'll blabber on. I picked up the guitar at school, blah, blah. I ended up in a little punk band, made a couple of tunes. I suppose the big thing I had before, I made now and produced by Mick Ronson, Bowie's guitarist in the mid-80s, but he didn't do anything. I was really young. I was still working in and doing all the jobs. Blah, blah, blah. So Acid House hit. Yeah, and exactly, that's what happened, really. So I fell into those Spiral Tribe parties, which was like, so that was very punk rock. If you think about it, it was a massive reaction to the sort of £25 ticket. But think about it, £25 in 89. I haven't got the app or whatever, but I'm sure that's a lot of money. I never thought about that, actually. It must be over 50 quid to get into a rave. So anyway, so we put them on free. We used to just have donations. And we'd save up the money, you know, and so just to keep us going, you know, for the sound system, blah, blah, blah. So, and then I taught myself how to use, yeah, sampler, basic keyboard, because I was a guitarist really from school. And we started making records. So we made a couple of singles. But at the same time, I started the drum club, which is a club and a band. And we were sort of going early 90s, myself and a DJ Charlie Hall. So then we fell into that whole sort of thing. We were with that whole Aphex Twin, Spooky, drum club. It's that, you know, that whole scene that smashed out sort of like in the early 90s. So with Spiral Tribe, to be brutally honest, mate, Well, I had to stop really because I was just about, you know, we were all getting arrested. It was that bonkers, you know. We were doing these huge free parties. I mean, it culminated in Castle Morton. I don't know if you read about that one, which sort of brought on the Criminal Justice Bill in 1994. So everybody sort of buggered off, really, to like Czechoslovakia, first in front. So me and Charlie, and then we started the drum kit. It really was literally, I know it sounds very dramatic, but it was really, and they were sort of looking for me. It was quite funny, because my name, Lowell, and I was living with a flatmate, a girl at the time, over in West London, and literally come knocking on my, they thought, they were looking for a girl. Lowell, I've met a few girls, Lorraines are called Lowell, as well as Lorraines. So they knocked on the door, my flatmate, she answered, and then they said, oh, when do you know when she'll be back? And she, you know, they had 2 weeks to round everyone up. For this big court case that cost millions of taxpayers' money, all our money now, and it literally got thrown out. So there's this big case. I think they tried to make an example of us, you know. I mean, we weren't the only one. We're shutting down raves left, right, and centre. I mean, I don't know, you're too young, Lenny, but I'm sure you've heard of it. They had it. They vilified the whole smiley face. And yeah, it was bonkers on the front page of the Sun. It was like we were these evil. It was crazy, man. So I was very wrapped up in that. And it literally was, to carry on, I would have had to have gone to Europe. They all fled to Europe. Me and Charlie stayed behind and we started up a legal club called the Sound. That was behind I'll get there in a minute, Heaven, and Charing Cross, the drum club. It was a very successful club. And the band, so we just, the two of us. So we did the early singles with the Spiral Club. Then we started the drum club, which ran for a few years, blah, 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 blah. And then later on, and I started running a lot of clubs in Brixton after that. I was doing nights at Dogstar Mass. I got approached to do my first film called Southwest Nine. Obviously, with that postcode, it was set in Brixton. And they asked me to do a cameo. And I remember I was DJing. This girl kept giving me these pieces of paper. And I thought it was a wind-up, you know. She was just saying, we really want you. I was trying to play at the time for about 1,000 people. And she's shoving these pieces of paper. And it said, like, we need you in a... So, because they wanted it to be as authentic, and I was Mr. Brixton DJ at the time, and they really wanted me to do a cameo in the film. I just thought, what the hell? Like a lot of these things, it's being in the right place at the right time, isn't it? So I went down to this shoot. It was like the club scene, 99, 2000, around there, in a church in Brixton. And I got in there, and the first person I recognised was Frank Harper. Do you know that actor? Football Factory, and he's in loads of, he's a great actor, actually. And he's in Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels, you know.
Yeah, he is, isn't he? Yeah, you're right, yeah.
Yeah, I've got the guy that smashes up Vinnie Jones at the end. And I recognised him straight away, and Lock, Stock had been huge. It was a big film, wasn't it? I think those two defining films at the end of that, the 90s, were probably Trainspotting and Lock, Stock, weren't they? Huge. Mm. And... So I recognised Frank, so I thought, bloody hell, it's a proper film, you know. A couple of characters holding a Super 8, you know. And then that all went well, but and it turned out the guy who directed it, Richard Parry, he loved my band, The Drum Club, and he asked me to be the music supervisor on his film. And I really didn't know what that meant, Lenny.
Wow, there and then.
About 2 weeks later, he loved The Drum Club.
Yeah.
The Drum Club track went flying straight in. I did a new version with Lindy Layton from Beats International, you know, that'd be good to me. A song called Alchemy. Yeah, 2 or 3 weeks later, he just said, I'd love you to be the music supervisor. And I literally didn't know what it was. And it was a very strange, mystified job then. I don't know if Gemma, she doesn't go back that far either. But I don't know. It was a very strange time. There was very few British films. And they all seemed to be done by this woman called Liz Gallagher, who I never met. We ended up in L.A., it was tiny, the film industry then. And I couldn't get, it was hard to get, it was so to like, I was just trying to find, I was sort of learning as I went through, Lenny. It was bonkers. I remember phoning that record companies, asking to speak to the sink department. And loads of people, one person thought I was talking about the kitchen, you know. And literally loads of people didn't know what I was talking about. I won't name the companies because they'd be embarrassed now. It was such a sort of, it was very early. And I remember, so I did Southwest Nine. I sort of got through that. And then the next one I did was Football Factory in 2000, which exploded really,
didn't
it? Yeah. Film. But I was still finding my way. And I mean, it was good in one way because people didn't know what, you know, so you could cut really good deals. So they didn't know what you're talking about. But loads of the time, it was unbelievable. I had lawyers phoning me, asking for my advice. You know, it just, it got so ridiculous. It was such a strange sort of a job in those times. And then obviously it got really bad, didn't it? Record royalties, you know, with internet, you know, after Napster, blah, blah, blah. And it became a really important revenue stream. And I noticed over the next few years, it started to become, everybody got really into it and everyone had a sync department. It became a real sort of, and Jet Gemma, people that would testify, it became serious business where people used to just give a trolley track, so, you know, a pint of Guinness and a couple of bags of crisps. And suddenly they thought, hold on a minute here. You know, I remember people saying to me, you know, oh my God, those deals we've done with you, Lowell, you know, you know, if we knew it. So, I mean, they weren't terrible, but in my defense, I didn't know exactly what I was sort of blundering through. So that was a massive change in the industry. Anyway, so that's the last 20 years, been composing and music supervision for lots of films. I produced a couple of films as well. I did one with Rio Ferdinand called 90 Minutes, and I did a really cool film called 21 Miles about the Calais refugee camp with a really good director, Richard Parry. So it's been quite a journey, Lenny.
It doesn't half sound like it, and I'm sure there's still plenty more to come. I'd like to focus in now on your work within the world of music supervision and to try and get a little insight into the inner workings of the business, but more specifically, your creative process within that world.
Yeah, no, totally. Good question, mate. So where I jump in, I suppose, is script stage, often given a script. Don't have to go on set, but I often like to go down, you know, once or twice. I've done loads of films, mate, like Bronson, for instance. I never went on set one day. There's loads of films like that. But I do like soaking it up a bit and just seeing. So I do like going on set. But, you know, say the average shoot's about 6 weeks. So I'll probably pop down a couple of times, you know, just to get a vibe. And it's nice to be part of the process, meet everyone. So script. And then after they finish shooting, bring back all the footage. And then I suppose an assembly, usually be an assembly of sort of about 2 hours if it's a feature film, which they fine cut from to bring it down, you know, to about hour and a half, 90 minutes. So, because the big thing is, the way it's all changed, when they used to just shoot on film, they're very tight. All those classic films that me and you probably like, Apocalypse Now or whatever, yeah. And The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, and even Alien, whatever, you know, all those amazing films, they're probably only a little bit of extras. There's probably only a few. But now, because of digital, it's nuts. When we did It's All Gone Pete Tong, the clubbing film, they come back from Ibiza with 90 hours.
Good luck editing that.
So in many ways, that's made the whole process a lot more complicated, really, because they used to make it, because the film was so expensive, you know, people like Kubrick, so it's very tight. There'd be like an extra 3 minutes, 4 minutes. And so, you know, so now they come back with all this footage and they spend days, weeks trying to find the film. So I can't really get involved in that stage. I can pop in, whatever. But so the obvious thing is, Lenny, if I start I could start placing tracks, music to scenes that are not going to make the final cut. So I'm just wasting my time.
Yeah.
So I have to get it down to about 2 hours. So that's become, since digital has become, not everyone, but so many filmmakers. In many ways, it's bad. You know, when you've got too many ways you can go. So there's all these different. You know, and one person wants, the one producer likes it like that, never producer. So in many ways, the back end of digital, it's made it more, too many options. But when they get it down to about 2 hours, then I'll go to the edit suite, see that 2 hours, and there'll be scenes that I know are not going to disappear and start working on that. So a lot of the films are music, often, I was talking to this guy, this other new company, I'll do music supervision and composing, which is really rare. You know, I don't know anyone that does that. There are in America, but not here. So some films I'm just the music supervisor. Some films I'm just the composer, and some films I do both. So it's always different. But a lot of films I do both. But so And I license in tracks as well, hence working with people like Gemma. So and so then I mark the whole film. I go through the whole film, spotting session they called. I'll do that with the director, then he literally work through, number all the scenes, like say 1 to 50. And literally, do we think that should be scored? Do we think that should be a track? Do we think that should be, is that coming out of a radio or just a bit of background? So and then we literally go through the whole film, spotting, agreeing, all that. And then I literally start feeding music to the edit. It's not millions of people, it's usually just the editor and the director. So you have a close relationship with the editor as well as the director. But usually they have to part, you know, everything has to go through the director or the editor. I mean, but that's all very different. Every film's different because directors often, some editors, they give more control sometimes. Especially one director might work with the same editor for 30 years. So they get to, so they trust them. But that's not always the case. So that's always different. So you build up, so there's usually the three of you. It's like a little triangle. The editor, the director, and yourself, and you bat stuff backwards and forwards. I can also put scenes on my computer. So I might run a bit of music, put it in and fire that off. And literally, yeah, I suppose the big thing is to work out what is score and what is tracks. Then we get these tracks, and then my job as well, another part of my job is to go and clear them with the record companies and the publishers, you know, the master and the composition. Yeah. And then I strike the deals and usually get a lawyer, sometimes myself, to do the paperwork. Usually it's a simple 2-3 page contract. Most people want the tracks in perpetuity, so it's forever, you know, obviously. So there's quite a lot to the job, really. It sounds quite an easy job on the surface, but
use that track, job done.
And obviously the directors, especially with their first films, they had this whole wish list, you know, they want Led Zeppelin here, the Stones there, and the Beatles, and Michael Jackson cutting into the Beach Boys going through, the Beastie Boys, you know. No, guys, we can't do any of that. Because, I mean, some of these artists are so expensive, you know. So to give you, so an average feature film, British feature film, is probably about £1.5 million budget. The tracks are clear. It's usually about £1.5-2 grand aside, you know, two for record master, two for publishing, so about £4 grand a track. That's an average. And you could do a thing called Most Favoured Nations, where everybody gets the same, which Gemma probably, which is really cool. So I've done films like that. So, because no one likes the idea, like say you're in Tears for Fears and I was in Adam the Ants, and you're getting, you know, £3 grand for that track, and I'm getting £1 grand. I think, hold on a minute, why am I? So you can do that. I've done films like that where it's Most Favoured Nations, everybody's on the same. And then there's artists, there's Prince, who doesn't clear for anything, even since he's died, who I love as an artist. Then you've got people like Michael Jackson, Pink Floyd, Led Zeppelin, who just cost so much money. Well, I've had big artists help me. I've had Coldplay have helped me actually work with me on two films, and that if they're into it, they will really help. There's all that sort of thing as well.
I was going to ask, actually, do you find there's a want from certain labels and artists to go out of their way in order to support British film?
Yeah, totally. I've gone direct to the artists or their management, and they're into it, and they can get on the phone. You know, Coldplay have been very supportive, Paul Weller, Jam, and it's been, who love British cinema, and they will sort of say to the record company publisher, no, we really want to do this film. Can you care it for that rather than? So there are some really good people out there. I work closer with the Streets, yeah, Coldplay, Weller's great, the Specials, Jerry Jam. There's loads of British artists. And that's another thing. The moment you go to America, across the old pond, everything goes up about 3-4 times. And I don't know what you're talking about. You're on the phone, you know, to someone at Warner's in America. Hey, what are you saying, man? I'll say that the film budget's only £1.5 million. £1.5 million, man, we pay that for the catering here, boy. it's a different world. It's a different world. I mean, because when a film comes out in America, I don't know what, I mean, some of the films I've done in this country are only released on 20 cinemas, you know, all the independent cinemas in this country, you know, like Duke of York, Brighton, and Harbour Light, Southampton, and but America, an average release, it's like 300 cinemas. It's all bigger scale. I have cleared American tracks, but whenever the American song artist put, I always think, oh no, here we go. It's terrible. But some of them are good, they're helpful. I just don't understand British, as a rule. There have been good ones, but as a rule, I just don't understand. It's so much smaller, the British independent cinema. So I try to stay more British. So yeah, no, it's quite a process. It is. And every film's different. You know, every film's different. The proportion of source tracks, that's what we call tracks that I've cleared, and score. And then there might, you know, there's films I don't know, they're all score. There's three tracks, hardly anything. Then you get, on average, say a film like The Firm. Do you know those films like Football Factory?
Yeah.
So they're probably about 12 source tracks. 12 tracks and a score, which will probably, the score will probably be made up of about 25, 30 cues. Mm. So that's a sort of probably an average film. Yeah. So it's
amazing.
It's an interesting process.
You mentioned there that you compose and produce music yourself. Are there any projects you've got going on at the moment that we can share?
Well, I'm nearly finished an album with Larry Love, or Rob Spraggs. Larry Love, the main man from Alabama 3. They obviously do the theme to The Sopranos, you know, Woke Up This Morning. So I'm just finishing an album with him. I've got a project called Are We Superheroes, a more indie thing that's coming out on part of Real World called X Records. What else am I doing? Doing an album with Duncan Forbes, who's an electronic band, Spooky. I mean, I've been doing stuff with Heather Small, you know, M People. We released a single earlier this year. Called United Together, which is very cool. And we gave a donation, 10% goes to Rio Ferdinand. He's been working with Rio's Ferdinand and his foundation. A new company called Fire in the Hole approached me about two new films, actually. London gangster movie and a Western called Lone Creek. So I'll be, they could be my next two things. What else have I been doing? I'm always up to something.
I was going to say, you're not slowing down at all.
I think I'm speeding up, Lenny. It's all like, it's the new slow machine I've invested in. I love it, mate. You know, Jesus, you know, it's not rocket science, is it? And, you know, it's a brain surgery or going down a coal mine, mate. So I don't mind, you know, we're lucky to be doing what we're doing.
I couldn't agree more. We're not out here saving lives, are we? So to finish off, can you recommend something that we should read, watch, or listen to that has helped you gain an insight into a culture unfamiliar to your own?
I love films like, I love going to places like Morocco, India, just that whole explosion of senses and colour. And City of God was good, wasn't it? The Brazilian. I was briefly friends with a Brazilian footballer, actually. And he comes from the favelas. He's played for Spurs and a couple of meet. I found that really insightful. I mean, I love French cinema. I mean, I just try and think. I'll tell you a great film I've seen, best film I've seen in the last couple of months. I think Nomadland. Have you seen that?
No, I haven't, no.
I really like that. Absolutely beautiful film. Nocturnal Animals, I loved a couple of years ago, Tom Ford. That was a great film. Yeah, no, this is. Serious wise, I just watched with a friend of mine. She loves her. Just watched all the Black Mirrors. I love that. It's basically, I was recording a lot with her. So she's got a studio and she's got a set up above studio. So after recorded, you know, I was staying there working. We watch a Black Mirror every night, you know.
Yeah.
I love the whole concept. It's good, isn't it? So I like the way it all threads together. I thought it was very clever. And music wise, I like the really quite a. Out their name, A Winged Victory for the Sullen. They make a couple of composers. One of them, he does all, not Francis, Sofia Coppola's films, he does one of them. Dustin O'Halloran, two guys, and Adam Wiltsey, A Winged Victory for the Sullen. Their music's beautiful, I really like their music.
I'll make sure there's some links to all the recommendations you just mentioned in the description so people can go and find it. I just want to say a huge thank you for taking the time today to chat to me. It's genuinely been such a pleasure. I could sit here for 4 hours and chat to you, but it's going to make the editing job an absolute nightmare for me. So
I hope there's a little insight on that world, you know.
I'm sure you got as much insight into Lowell's world as I did. I'll finish by saying another huge thank you to Lowell for sitting down to chat with me. It was genuinely such a pleasure. And I hope that we have many more conversations together in the future. As always, I'll leave some links in the description to all of the recommendations that Lowell made. Until next time.